Welcome to the Yes, Asking for Foreign Governments for Political Favors Breaks the Law conference call. My name is Paulette and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session. During the question and answer session, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Erin Klopak. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Paulette, and thank you all for joining us today for Yes, Asking Foreign Governments for Political Favors Breaks the Law. My name is Erin Klopak. I'm Director of Campaign Finance Strategy at the Campaign Legal Center, and I will be your moderator today. During today's call, you will hear analysis from CLC's legal experts about foreign election interference, the President's recent campaign finance violations and abuses of power. We'll also discuss the criminal indictment last week of two Ukrainian Americans for campaign finance violations based on a complaint filed by CLC. And we'll also discuss how their activities fit into the larger story. A few weeks ago, a whistleblower complaint revealed that during a phone call this summer, President Trump pressured Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate one of Trump's opponents in the upcoming presidential election. A White House summary of the call and testimony and texts by State Department officials corroborate the whistleblower's account. Those sources collectively indicate that while Trump was blocking congressionally approved aid to Ukraine, he told Zelensky that U.S. support for Ukraine has not always been reciprocal, and then asked Zelensky for a favor, to work with Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and the U.S. Attorney General to investigate Trump's potential 2020 rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. Trump's direct request that President Zelensky use Ukraine's government resources to investigate Biden and his family serves no apparent purpose other than to benefit Trump's reelection efforts. By directly requesting or suggesting that President Zelensky use Ukraine's resources to help his reelection efforts, Trump violated campaign finance law and committed a stunning abuse of power. And then he did it all over again, publicly asking China to conduct its own investigation of Vice President Biden. The president's legal and ethical abuses have led to an impeachment inquiry by the House of Representatives. And in the midst of these developments, just days ago, the Department of Justice indicted two Ukrainian-American businessmen for a variety of criminal campaign finance violations, including illegally laundering a six-figure contribution to a pro-Trump super PAC and spending foreign funds in U.S. elections. Notably, the same two men were also working with Giuliani on his efforts to get Ukraine to investigate Biden and to have the U.S. ambassador to that country removed because they saw her as an obstacle to their personal business interests. Is there a connection between these individual campaign finance violations and their work for Giuliani? Are there connections to Trump's own campaign's violations? We will discuss these and many other issues with CLC experts today. After we hear from all of today's speakers, we will open the conversation up for questions and answers from the audience. At this time, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Trevor Potter. Trevor is the founder and president of Campaign Legal Center and a former Republican chairman of the Federal Election Commission. To many, Trevor is perhaps best known for his recurring appearances on the Colbert Report as a lawyer for Stephen Colbert's super PAC during the 2012 election. The American Bar Association Journal has described Trevor as hands down one of the top lawyers in the country on the delicate intersection of politics, law, and money. Trevor, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Erin. This is an unusual moment because everyone is suddenly focused on violations of campaign finance law. The most recent development last Thursday, the news of the arrest and indictment of two Ukrainian Americans, Igor Fruman and Lev Parnas, brought a number of important new details to light, but also raised many more questions. We are still learning, virtually every hour, new details of this story, but what is clear so far is two things. First, that these two individuals saw large U.S. political contributions as key to gaining entry into the Trump orbit and entry to Congress, and it appears to have worked for them. Second, that their ensuing Ukraine activities, working with Rudy Giuliani set into motion the circumstances that culminated in President Trump asking the Ukrainian president for a, quote, favor in the phone call. As Brendan Fisher will describe in more detail in a moment, CLC first brought this matter to the attention of the Federal Election Commission and the public last year when we linked a mysterious $325,000 super PAC contribution to Igor Fruman and Lev Parnas, two Ukrainian-American businessmen living in Florida. It appeared at the time, and has since been confirmed, that they illegally laundered funds from unknown sources to America First Action, the Trump super PAC, through a shell corporation called Global Energy Producers, GEP. What immediately caught our attention when we first heard of this large super PAC contribution was the fact that this LLC had formed only weeks before making the six-figure contribution, and it appeared to have no evidence of any business activity. Through matching up addresses and contribution records and other research, we were able to connect Fruman and Parnas to this LLC. We then filed a complaint with the FEC in July of 2018, requesting an investigation into whether they violated campaign finance law by making the contribution in the name of GEP, an apparent shell entity. Then, in June of this year, we filed a supplemental complaint with the FEC, incorporating new details that had come to light from a lawsuit filed against the two businessmen by a third party in Florida this spring. Last week's arrest and indictment of Fruman and Parnas highlighted all of these facts. The indictment alleges, among other things, that Fruman and Parnas made false statements to the FEC in responses to the allegations in our complaint, such as claiming that GEP was a legitimate business entity with real business revenue. But the story is far from over. We still don't know where that money came from, and the indictment raised a number of new questions. It's worth remembering, of course, that before the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, corporations, even legitimate ones, could not spend unlimited amounts in our elections and could not give to super PACs. Fundamentally, the federal indictment paints a deeply troubling picture of our campaign finance system. Fruman and Parnas made the $325,000 contribution in order to, quote, obtain access to exclusive political events and gain influence with politicians, close quote. And they made it in the name of the shell corporation in order to, quote, conceal the true source of the contributions. Now, that second part is illegal. Federal law prohibits anyone from making what the law calls contributions in the name of another. That's what CLC alleged in its original complaint with the FEC, and the indictment alleges it too. But the first part, the giving of large sums of money to super PACs in order to gain access and influence politicians, that has become the new norm in our political system. The indictment lays out the corrupting path of these contributions. Money buys access to political insiders running super PACs, who then use the power of their influence to introduce large donors to the president and to members of Congress. The indictment says that the Ukrainian Americans met Congressman One at an event hosted by the super PAC. That led to an official meeting with the congressman and a pledge by the Ukrainians to raise money for the congressman's campaign, some of which turned out to be illegal funds. The congressman also benefited hugely from millions of dollars of supposedly independent spending on his reelection campaign by his friends at the super PAC. add secret sources of funding for these contributions to the mix, and we have a brew of corruption and the potential for corruption, as the prosecutors laid out in their indictment. Reading the prosecutors' language, it is clear that they are shocked by this trail of corruption. However, unfortunately, thanks to Citizens United and the regulatory and legislative inaction that has followed, this is now the normal mode of operation in our campaign finance system. Every election cycle, more and more money from undisclosed sources floods our elections, and political contributions to super PACs and secretly funded nonprofits are increasingly understood as the way to gain access in Washington. Many politicians have explicitly acknowledged that political contributions impact who gets meetings and who has their ear on policy priorities. That is something that Fruman and Parnas capitalized on to great success, but it is certainly not unique to these two. Thank you.
Thank you, Trevor. Please remember that we will take questions after we hear from all of today's speakers. Next, I would like to welcome Brendan Fisher. Brendan directs CLC's work before federal regulatory agencies such as the Federal Election Commission to ensure vigorous and fair enforcement of campaign finance and ethics laws, and to hold candidates and political committees accountable for violating those laws.
Thank you, Erin. So President Trump's pressure on Ukraine to investigate his political rivals was the culmination of a year-long influence campaign set into motion by two Soviet foreign men who bought access to the president's inner circle with hundreds of thousands of dollars of laundered political contributions. So as Trevor described, in July of 2018, CLC uncovered how the two men, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, directed $325,000 to President Trump's super PAC through a shell corporation called Global Energy Producers LLC, or GEP. And our complaint led to the arrest of Mr. Parnas and Mr. Fruman last week. As the indictment describes, Parnas and Fruman engaged in this big money scheme to buy access and influence, and they used it to push the same theories about Ukraine, the U.S. ambassador, and the Biden family that President Trump espoused in his July 2019 call with Ukraine's president. And President Trump's efforts to abuse his power to pursue these theories have led to impeachment proceedings. So I'm going to give the backstory of our complaint and describe what we know and still don't know about this pair and their influence efforts. So back in July of 2018, Lachlan Marquet at the Daily Beast first flagged a contribution to the super PAC, America First Action, from this mysterious company called GEP. And what initially caught our attention is that GEP seemed to fit the profile of an LLC straw donor. And there's a history of wealthy donors setting up an LLC, putting money into the LLC, and making large super PAC contributions in the name of the LLC rather than in their own name, thereby keeping their own identity a secret. And at first, that's what GEP looked like. The company was formed, and just weeks later gave $325,000 to America First Action. And there was no evidence that GEP generated the business revenue or income to cover that six-figure contribution during its short existence. And the company didn't even have a website. After a careful review of federal and state political contribution records, we were able to connect GEP to Parnas and Fruman. And although there was little information about Parnas and Fruman in the U.S. media, our examination of Russian-language Ukrainian media showed that the pair had been speaking quite publicly in Ukraine about their U.S. political contributions and sharing pictures of themselves with President Trump and other U.S. political figures. We allege in our FEC complaint that the money that was attributed to GEP actually came from some other source and violated the straw donor ban. And as last week's indictment shows, we were right. But the story has several other layers to it. So in the year plus since the GEP contribution and CLC's complaint, Parnas and Fruman became major players in Trump world, thanks in no small part to their flurry of political contributions in early 2018. Between February and July of 2018, the pair gave or directed $675,000 to at least 14 candidates or committees. And the indictment makes clear that their donations were aimed at gaining access to politicians and they've used that access to promote at least two major issues in U.S.-Ukraine relations. So first, Parnas and Fruman were central to the ultimately successful campaign to remove the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. And second, the pair connected Giuliani to the Ukrainian political elite, some of whom were pursuing their own political vendettas or interests in order to advance claims about the Biden family and about Ukraine's alleged role in influencing the 2016 election. President Trump, of course, picked up on these themes and appears to have subverted U.S. foreign policy to advance his personal political interests as well as the private interests of these two shady political donors. So I'll discuss Ambassador Yovanovitch first. So one of the most striking examples of Fruman and Parnas using political contributions to buy access was with Representative Pete Sessions of Texas, who apparently opened his doors in response to this political giving. And then, at the apparent request of this pair, he urged Secretary of State Pompeo to fire the U.S. ambassador. So in May of 2018, around the same time that Parnas and Fruman were directing $325,000 to America First Action, the pair met personally with Sessions in his D.C. office. And on or around the same day, Sessions sent that letter to Pompeo, citing concrete evidence from close companions that Yovanovitch had criticized Trump. Parnas and Fruman followed up the Sessions meeting with two maxed-out political contributions, but it appears that it was the super PAC contribution that helped open Sessions' door in the first place. We know that the super PAC that Parnas and Fruman helped fund through GEP would spend $3 million in Sessions' race that year. We know that the super PAC's finance chair, Roy Bailey, is close friends with Sessions and had previously been Sessions' campaign chair. And Bailey is also a partner at Giuliani's consulting firm, Giuliani LLC. And we know that Giuliani would headline a fundraiser for Sessions later in 2018. We learned yesterday that Sessions has received a subpoena in a grand jury investigation into Giuliani in the Southern District of New York. So I just want to pause for a minute and point out how this is a really stunning example of the pay-to-play that has become far too common in our political system. Sessions had little apparent background in Ukrainian politics or in U.S.-Ukraine relations, but by all appearances, he was willing to insert himself into these complicated foreign policy matters because a pair of big donors had asked him to. And Parnas and Fruman's push to remove Yovanovitch was operating in parallel with their efforts to promote the narrative about and an investigation into the Biden family in Ukraine. So making political contributions was one way for Parnas and Fruman to buy access and build influence, and helping to generate dirt on President Trump's political rivals was another. Parnas reportedly first met Giuliani at a Trump fundraiser in October 2016, but the relationship appears to have deepened following the six-figure super PAC contribution. And starting in mid to late 2018, the pair began working more closely with Giuliani on Ukraine matters, which included making introductions to Ukrainian officials, setting up meetings, and otherwise liaising between Giuliani and their contacts in Ukraine. And those efforts, of course, laid the key groundwork for Trump's own intervention in Ukraine this summer. So I think a big outstanding question is why? Why did Parnas and Fruman do this? What were they after? Certainly, we know, according to the indictment, that they were after, they were aimed at advancing their personal financial interest and the political interest of at least one Ukrainian government official with whom they were working. We know that Parnas and Fruman were seeking to engineer a corrupt business plan to restructure the Ukrainian state energy company and to get contracts to import liquefied natural gas to Ukraine. Ambassador Yovanovitch was a vocal critic of corruption in Ukraine, and the pair viewed her as an obstacle to those efforts. But there were many other actors in or around Ukraine whose interests might also be served by these efforts. Now, wealthy oligarchs with a major stake in Ukrainian energy, for example, could also benefit from restructuring the state energy company. Political actors like prosecutor Yuri Lutsenko had grudges against Ambassador Yovanovitch. And there were many others in Ukraine who stood to benefit from the removal of a U.S. ambassador who opposed corruption in the country. So here's why this matters. Here's why I'm saying this. The fact that other actors would also benefit from these activities is important because we still don't really know where the money came from for Parnas' and Fruman's influence efforts. One of Parnas' businesses reportedly paid Giuliani, for example, $500,000 in 2018, But given what we know about Parnas and its history of debt, it's reasonable to question whether that money actually originated from somewhere else. For example, in May of 2018, Parnas himself couldn't even afford to cover the promised $2,800 contribution to Pete Sessions and had to use money from Igor Fruman. If Parnas couldn't afford a $2,800 political donation, how could he afford a $500,000 consulting fee right around the same time? So it's not at all clear that Parnas, Fruman, and Giuliani were acting entirely on their own behalf when pushing these Ukraine theories. We don't know where the money came from, nor is it really known how any wealthy interests who are providing the funds might stand to benefit. So just two more quick points. One is that these arrests underscore the importance of watchdogs like CLC in our political system. Neither the FEC nor the DOJ is actively reviewing campaign finance reports and doing additional research to identify the kind of illegal activity that we first identified back in July 2018. It falls on civil society watchdogs like CLC to uncover these kinds of violations and file complaints with the FEC or other agencies. And in this instance, our complaint triggered a DOJ investigation. And then finally, big picture, you know, the indictment of Parnas and Fruman is really an indictment of our big money political system. It's a stunning example of the cash for access system that has become far too commonplace and is warping our democracy. With that, I'll end. Thank you.
Thank you, Brendan. Now I would like to introduce our next speaker, Delaney Marsco. As legal counsel for CLC's ethics program, Delaney focuses on ethics, accountability, and transparency.
Thanks, Erin. So I'm going to discuss some of the ethics implications surrounding the conduct underlying the impeachment probe, specifically related to the people in the president's orbit who have been essential to the Ukrainian influence effort at the heart of the inquiry. Rudy Giuliani, as mentioned previously, is one of these central figures. Giuliani has been traveling the world, holding himself out as a U.S. government operative, engaging in an unknown amount of unofficial diplomacy, and insisting at the same time that his work is not only officially sanctioned by the president, but assisted by the State Department. When President Trump sought help from the Ukrainian president with investigations relating to the DNC and Hunter Biden on the call that launched the impeachment proceedings, the president listed Giuliani and Attorney General Bill Barr as the two point people on these matters. So Giuliani seems to be playing a major role in U.S. foreign policy, yet Giuliani holds no official position in President Trump's cabinet or the administration at all. The president's private lawyer is not charging Trump for his services, but he and his consulting firm have dozens of clients, including foreign entities, who are paying him for whatever services they think Giuliani can provide for them, possibly access to the president and other high-ranking U.S. officials. Giuliani's unusual arrangement allows him to work for the president on what appears to be official state business, while his paycheck comes from unknown foreign interests. The public has been totally in the dark about the wealthy special interests who might be subsidizing Giuliani's gratis work for Trump, or for whom he might actually be working while invoking Trump's name and the U.S. State Department. Because Giuliani is not officially a federal employee, he has been able to sidestep ethics obligations that would require transparency behind the foreign or domestic interests who are paying him. Executive branch officials, even temporary or part-time ones, and including unpaid ones, must file regular financial disclosure reports. For senior officials, like those who meet with foreign leaders and make high-level foreign policy decisions, these reports are public record and available online. The regular disclosure of information like debts and income streams allows the public to see whether an official has a private financial interest that they could advance through their public position, and it allows the public to hold them accountable for that. We do not have any of that financial information for Giuliani, but someone is writing his checks, and as he engages in unofficial diplomacy in Ukraine, some of which is designed to hamstring the president's political rivals, the public has no clue whose money is funding the effort. What little we do know doesn't come from mandatory disclosure. It has been revealed at the discretion of Giuliani himself or through media reporting and law enforcement. For example, we have learned that Giuliani's client list does include recently indicted Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, who allegedly paid Giuliani $500,000 to do consulting work for one of their businesses. We also know that Parnas, Fruman, and Giuliani worked together to get information from Ukrainian officials to senior U.S. administration officials. But the American public should not have had to wait for an impeachment inquiry and a criminal indictment of the president's lawyer's associates to know whose money is funding Giuliani's foreign policy efforts. In addition to the disclosure of financial interests, federal employees are forbidden from participating in certain matters that would affect those interests. The criminal conflict of interest law, for example, bars government employees, including even temporary or part-time employees, from using the levers of government power for their own personal financial gain or for the benefit of their private clients. Again, because Giuliani represents the president but doesn't really work for the federal government, he doesn't have that same legal duty to act in the public's interest. He's seemingly free to hold himself out as someone acting on behalf of the U.S. government, but without those legal obligations that would prevent him from using that authority to line his pockets, perform political favors, or advance the interests of himself or his unknown clients. Giuliani's relationship to unknown foreign clients and non-government political operatives also raises questions about what sort of disclosures he should have made to the Department of Justice about any influence activities on behalf of foreign clients. Under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA, any person who tries to influence the U.S. government or the public on behalf of a foreign individual or entity must register with DOJ and provide a list of their activities. Giuliani has made no such disclosures, despite apparently ginning up the firing of a U.S. ambassador and advancing Ukrainian investigations on behalf of Ukrainian foreign nationals. Now Giuliani appears to be under federal investigation, potentially for this failure to register. Financial disclosure, the criminal conflict of interest law, and FARA are just a few tools in the ethics toolbox that provide the transparency necessary to hold federal employees accountable. The standards of conduct, the ethics pledge, and the impartiality regulation all help ensure that government business is being done with the best interests of the public in mind. All of these rules exist for the same reason, to ensure that public service remains a public trust. And Giuliani, the person to whom foreign operatives are flocking for advice and access to the president, seems to be bound by none of them. This arrangement leaves the public in the dark about who might be bankrolling these shadow foreign policy efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Delaney. Our final speaker today is Adav Noti, CLC's Senior Director of Trial Litigation and Chief of Staff. In addition to directing CLC's strategic litigation, Adav has litigated dozens of constitutional cases in district courts, courts of appeals, and the United States Supreme Court. As Chief of Staff, Adav also coordinates all of CLC's programmatic activities, including CLC's efforts to reform the campaign finance system and promote government ethics. For over 10 years, Adav served in several positions within the Office of General Counsel at the Federal Election Commission.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me on the call today. I want to just apologize first for the state of my voice here. I've spent the last couple of evenings at our lovely ballpark here in Washington, D.C., which is been a somewhat loud place lately, so I find myself a bit hoarse today. I'm going to focus today on a very specific issue, which I think has been misconstrued a bit, even in the world of campaign finance experts. And the issue is, what exactly did President Trump do in his phone call with the Ukrainian president that was against the law? The president's abuse of power in that call has been well described and well documented, but what was illegal about it? That's the question I'm going to address today. So under federal law, it's illegal to solicit any foreign national for a campaign contribution. And that's an important law. It's there to make sure that American elections are determined by Americans, not by foreign governments or foreign financial interests. So you can't solicit a foreign campaign contribution. In the president's call with the Ukrainian president, we clearly have a solicitation. So solicitation under the law just means to ask for something, and the evidence shows beyond any reasonable doubt that the president asked Ukraine to conduct an investigation of one of the president's political opponents. So there's no question that there was a solicitation. The question is whether that solicitation was for a campaign contribution. So there are a few different legal definitions of campaign contributions, and where I think the misunderstanding has come up here is that a lot of the reporting and discussion has focused on a particular definition of contribution in which the main question is whether the solicitation is for a quote-unquote thing of value. And the reason that's been so heavily discussed is that that is the definition of contribution that was at issue in Special Counsel Mueller's report on the Trump campaign's attempt to solicit campaign information from Russian sources. So just to distinguish between the two, in that case, you had Trump campaign officials asking what they believed to be a foreign government for derogatory material about Hillary Clinton. And the legal question was whether that material was a contribution, which turned on whether it was a thing of value. Now, there's a lot of precedent making clear that it is, that information is a thing of value to a campaign, and that's what the special counsel concluded. Yes, it would have been a contribution because damaging information about a political opponent is something of value to a campaign. The special counsel ultimately decided not to charge anybody for that solicitation because he thought it would be difficult to prove to a jury the exact value of the information, which he viewed as necessary to making out a criminal case. But the question about whether a solicitation is for a contribution plays out very differently in the Ukraine situation than it did for Russia. In the Russian solicitation, the material solicited had already been produced, and the campaign was just asking Russia to provide it or disseminate it. Here, the president wasn't asking for information. He was asking for action. The president asked the Ukrainian government to spend its own money to conduct an investigation that was intended to influence the U.S. election. So this is the key legal point. If a candidate asks someone to spend money to influence an election and they do it, that spending, by law, is a contribution. Right? For the legal wonks on the phone, that makes it a coordinated expenditure. It's not about the value of the information being produced by the activity or whatever plans there might be to disseminate it. If somebody acting at the president's request spends resources on an activity for the purpose of helping the president's reelection campaign, that person has made a campaign contribution. So by asking Ukraine to spend its resources to investigate someone whose only significance to the president was as a potential political opponent, the president solicited a campaign contribution from a foreign national. And the president said, please talk to my personal lawyer about why you should investigate an opposing candidate, that's asking Ukraine to spend its resources to harm an electoral opponent. And the purpose of harming an electoral opponent is to influence the election. So the president solicited a foreign national for a contribution in the form of a coordinated expenditure, and that's illegal under federal campaign finance law. So based on the evidence that's currently available, in addition to abusing the power of his office to further his own political interests, the evidence shows that the president did commit a violation of federal law in his call with the Ukrainian president, and that is a very serious matter.
Thank you, Adav. The four speakers we've heard from today will now be available for questions, along with Mark Lawrence Applebaum, CLC's Senior Advisor on Foreign Interference and Online Threats. Mark has extensive experience in technology, privacy, cybersecurity, and First Amendment issues, and he advises CLC on our work to confront foreign election interference and threats to U.S. elections. To kick off our Q&A session, Paulette will provide you with instructions to ask questions of our speakers.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There will be a delay before the first question is announced. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. Standing by for questions.
Well, while we let the questions queue up, I'll get us started. Brendan, do the allegations in the criminal indictment against Fruman and Parnas implicate anyone else? And do you have any predictions about what we should expect to see next?
So a few things. One is that President Trump's super PAC, America First Action, has so far escaped scrutiny, but could also face liability in these matters. So even before the indictment, we obtained wire transfer records that showed that the $325,000 contribution to America First Action never came from GEP at all. Instead, the super PAC received a wire transfer from an entirely different LLC managed by Parnas, called Aaron Investments One LLC, using funds transferred to it from a real estate attorney's client trust account. So despite the super PAC knowing that it received a contribution from Aaron Investments One LLC, it agreed to falsely attribute the funds to an entirely different entity, GEP. It's not clear why the super PAC agreed to go along with the scheme, and BuzzFeed did report last week that the super PAC's outside compliance firm actually questioned the misattribution of the contribution. But in reporting a contribution from one LLC as having come from an entirely different LLC, America First Action very likely violated the straw donor ban. It accepted a contribution from one entity and knowingly reported it as having come from another entity. And then the other possibility is violations of the Foreign Agent Registration Act, or FARA. If Giuliani, Fruman, or Parnas were acting to influence U.S. policy as an agent of, or at the order, request, or under the direction or control of a foreign principal, then they should have registered under FARA. The indictment does potentially hint at this. It says that Parnas was acting at the request of one or more Ukrainian government officials with respect to some of the influence activities, which does seem to hint at a potential FARA violation. And we know, particularly with respect to Mr. Giuliani, that potential FARA violations are a topic of inquiry by prosecutors.
Thanks, Brendan. Do we have a question in the queue?
Yes, we do. Our first question comes from Jeff Manning from Oregonian Newspaper. Please go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, guys. Really interesting stuff. Thanks for staging this. My question is a little bit provincial, but Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU, is scheduled to testify before the congressional committees tomorrow morning. Do you have any thoughts about the role played by Sondland, as well as Volker and other lower-level diplomats in this whole thing that were in Ukraine?
Brendan, you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent, their role remains to be seen. I mean, the information that has come out thus far shows that the pressure on Ukraine was not limited to the president's phone call with the Ukrainian president, that Sondland and Volker and Giuliani and others were engaging in efforts for weeks to pressure the Ukrainian government to investigate President Trump's political rivals. But one thing that's interesting about Sondland is that he effectively bought his way into this ambassador position, and he didn't do it in his own name. He, like Fruman and Parnas, made a contribution to support President Trump, but did it through an LLC. Sondland gave $1 million to the inaugural committee in 2017, but he did it not in his own name, but through four different LLCs that he controlled.
This is Trevor Potter. I would add to that I think it's clear the State Department officials, whether political ambassadors or career employees, were in a very difficult position here because they were trying to effectuate U.S. policy in Ukraine, which was to get the weapons that Congress had authorized, to have the new Ukrainian president meet senior officials in the U.S. government, including President Trump. And so they were trying to figure out what needed to happen in order for those events to occur. And in order to do so, they had to deal with the White House and Rudy Giuliani, who was presenting himself as the president's personal lawyer and the go-between for the State Department and the president's decisions on Ukraine. So as you can see from the text messages that have already been made public, they're pushing the official U.S. anti-corruption line and pro-Ukraine line, and trying to figure out how to make it happen when they were seeing this, to them, mysterious interference by Giuliani using the president's name and the White House name to intervene here.
Thank you, Brendan and
Very
Trevor.
Good. Thank you.
I think we have another call.
Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. And our next question comes from Tom Bruhn from Newsday. Please go ahead.
Yes. One of the donations that Fruman made was from a home on Long Island. The owner of that home, a guy named Stephen Fruman, said that that was false information. Is that a problem? I mean, can you make a donation from a false address?
Yeah, well, Stephen Fruman appears to be Igor Fruman's brother, I know that that's what Stephen Fruman had said initially back in or around July 2018 when the reports about the contribution and our complaint first started becoming public. So it's difficult to know what to make of that. I think it's certainly true that the indictment implies that many of the contributions made in Parnas's name, or in some cases in Fruman's name, actually did come from another source. There were some contributions from Parnas that were actually funded by Fruman. There were other contributions at the state level where the funds actually came from an unnamed foreign national. So I think there are still a number of unanswered questions about the nature of the contributions that were made in the name of these two.
Right, but just generally, I mean, is that a legal issue here of misidentifying the address from which you're making the contribution?
It could be a technical violation if they're making up an address or listing an address that's associated with another individual. But I think it would probably that technical violation would probably pale in comparison to the much more significant straw donor allegations against them.
And this is a Dobnoy. I would only add that possibly more significant than the misuse of the address is that it's another piece of evidence of the sort of larger scheme to conceal the sources of this fund. I mean, among other things, they intentionally misspelled their names a few times, right? These are all tricks to make it harder to figure out that these same two people were serving as conduits for large amounts of money.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, it sounds like we don't have another caller at the moment, so I'll ask another question. President Trump has indicated that he's not going to cooperate with the impeachment inquiry that's been launched by the House of Representatives. Trevor, can you talk about how that process is going to unfold and whether the president can get away with that?
Well, I think I'd start with the fact that the president and the White House counsel have called the current impeachment inquiry, the actions by the congressional committees, unconstitutional. The Constitution is quite clear. It says the House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment. It doesn't say anything further about the procedures the House should use, whether there needs to be a vote of the full House to authorize an impeachment committee, or whether the House can do impeachment through existing committees, which is what the leadership of the House has chosen to do. So I think it somewhat boggles the mind to say that a procedure that is specifically authorized in the Constitution and belongs only to the House is somehow unconstitutional. Professor Charles Fried of Harvard, who's a former Solicitor General of the United States in the Reagan administration, has publicly stated that the way to conceive of this is that the House of Representatives is like a grand jury. It can hear testimony, and at the end of the day, it can decide to bring charges, which it would do by having an impeachment vote. It doesn't have to bring charges, but if it chooses to, it uses its procedures, which it settles on, to hear evidence, and decide whether to bring impeachment charges. If that happens, the Constitution says the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments, and specifies that the Chief Justice would preside over the trial in the Senate. So the specifics that I think the President has been complaining about are the procedures the House is using, and those are not specified by the Constitution and left to the House. But Professor Fried's point has been the House effectively reviews the evidence, and if it chooses, sends charges to the Senate, and then there is a public trial with the right of due process in the Senate, where the President would be defended, and there would be prosecutors from the House laying out the evidence. And the Senate, of course, then takes a vote, and the Constitution requires a two-thirds majority to remove the President from office. So these are different stages, and that gets finally to the underlying issue of, you know, can the White House decide, quote, not to cooperate? The President can choose not to defend himself in the House if that's what he wants to do, but that's a very different question from, is the proceeding unconstitutional, and the President, can the President block officials of the executive branch from testifying, or can the President ignore subpoenas, or can other people in the executive branch ignore subpoenas that come from Congress in the course of this? And there, I think the answer pretty clearly is no. Congress is exercising its core constitutional responsibilities in the House, and Congress could act to enforce those subpoenas. And indeed, what we're seeing is that officials in the executive branch are complying with subpoenas and are testifying. And in the course of that, we're learning a great deal more about what actually happened in Ukraine and the context of the presidential request for a favor.
Thanks, Trevor. Okay, well, I'll ask another question. So we've been talking, Adav, you talked a lot about why President Trump's request that other countries investigate Vice President Biden is illegal foreign election interference. But why isn't Trump correct when he says that he's just trying to investigate and stop corruption, and he's allowed to do that as president? Is he prohibited from enlisting the help of other world leaders to investigate corruption when the investigation may involve a political opponent?
Right. Well, it's the intersection of the president's authority, constitutional authority, and the abuse of that authority, and the intersection of that with law that makes this a difficult and unprecedented situation. I think Trevor, Trevor had some thoughts in particular on sort of the history of presidential, the intersection of presidential foreign policy authority and political campaigning.
Well, the underlying question, of course, is was this, as Adav has outlined, an action or a request for action against a political opponent? It is sometimes said, well, everybody does this, by which I think is meant, well, presidents talk to lots of foreign leaders. That's, of course, true, but it is not correct to say that presidents ask foreign leaders for favors that are personal and political and benefit them as opposed to benefiting the United States. And in particular, here, foreign policy officials from, I think, almost every previous administration, those officials who are still around, have said that this, to them, is shocking, not business as usual, nothing that would have happened on their watch. The specific example of that is that it has now come out that in the closing days of the first President Bush's campaign for re-election against then-Governor Clinton, members of the House, Republican members of the House of Representatives, went to the President, first President Bush, and said, you've got to go after this guy. You've got to find out information about what he was doing with the anti-war movement in England and in Europe. And you need to call the English and ask for their intelligence information on Clinton. They're undoubtedly going to have something in their files. After that conversation and that request to Bush, the White House Chief of Staff, James Baker, wrote a formal memo that said, we will not do this. This is completely wrong, and explained that presidents do not ask for dirt on their political opponents from foreign governments, that that would be an abuse of power. And so we know that that administration, facing the same question, drew a red line and said this is the sort of thing that could not be done. So I think it's pretty clearly wrong to say that asking foreign governments for help in investigating a political opponent is in any sense common or fits within what have been the parameters of acceptable behavior by a president.
Thank you. Well, if we don't have any other calls, then I think we will conclude.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes our conference. If you do have additional questions, you can send them to info@campaignlegacycenter.org. Again, that's info@campaignlegacycenter.org. And thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.